Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Arun Vanagopal, and this is The Takeaway. Democratic candidates have been vying for the 2020 presidential nomination for well over a year now. And today, voters will finally get to weigh in during Iowa's caucuses. But many parents in the state, especially women who want to caucus today, will run into a familiar problem: childcare. And despite the childcare gap closing in recent years, women are still 8 times more likely than fathers to be the primary caretaker of children in heterosexual relationships. And unlike in traditional primaries where voters just cast a ballot, caucuses are long, complicated, and public processes. People gather in places like schools or libraries to convince members of the community to support their preferred candidate.
The caucuses are basically like gathering all your friends and neighbors into a big gymnasium or church basement and moving your body from corner to corner to vote for the Democratic candidate that you want to be the presidential nominee.
And that is
Liz Lenz. I am a columnist for the Cedar Rapids Gazette.
Liz recently spoke with several women in Iowa about how difficult it can be for them as parents to participate in this process.
Everybody's got a different solution. Some are bringing their kids. Some are hiring babysitters, but some are just staying home altogether because, you know, their kids might not be able to be with the sitter. Some have high needs kids. Some have tiny little babies who are still breastfeeding, you know, and so it's really so many people have so many different workarounds to this problem.
Recently, the issue of childcare has become visible enough that candidates are taking steps to solve it themselves.
Some campaigns are actually trying to work out babysitters and having on-site babysitting, which is great, but it is, again, not a full solution to all parents because some parents don't trust, you know, a stranger to babysit their child. So there's just a lot of ways parents are trying to figure this out.
And it's not just a matter of childcare. For many women, the very public nature of the caucus is a barrier too.
For women who are in abusive situations or are in more stressful marriages, it can be just compounded, you know, by the public nature of the vote, by who's responsible for childcare, by who's willing to take that step and do, you know, these public voting processes. And I think it's just all those little individual stories that add up to the silencing of so many women in Iowa.
For more on the national barriers to political participation for women, we turn to Kelly Dittmar, assistant professor of political science at Rutgers University and scholar at the Center for American Women and Politics. Kelly, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
So these problems in Iowa, this is just one example of the institutional barriers to women's political involvement, correct?
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to think about the origins of our political system and realize that these were institutions built for and by men. And so we see different structures, different rules, different norms and practices that have really advantaged and made life easier for men when it comes to not only just political participation, but of course, running for winning office and holding elective office.
Is this basically the, the catch-22 that you don't have more women in higher office who can advocate for allowing more women to participate in the process?
Well, I mean, like I said, I think we have to be careful in the sense that the barriers to broad participation, women have really pushed through, right? Mm-hmm. So the fact that, again, women are the most reliable voters, even in the Iowa caucuses tonight, women will very likely outnumber men. Part of that, I think, is due to women's really persistence. You know, nevertheless, she persisted. Mm-hmm. Women have figured out how to push through some of the barriers. One of the things to consider, of course, is what would happen if those barriers went down? You might see even greater participation, activity, engagement, et cetera, from women, and especially at those levels of participation that become harder and harder. So those are the things that require more persistent participation, more regular time commitments, et cetera, and more financial costs. And so you might see that. The importance of having women as candidates and office holders, of course, there is some evidence that there is a symbolic importance. In other words, seeing more women in office can make women and also other marginalized populations see this as a possibility for themselves. So we talk about it as political efficacy. And there have been some studies that show that when women are both on the ballot as well as representing you in office, that you might see greater engagement across different levels of participation by women. And that's important. We know that women don't just vote for women. They vote for the candidate who they align with most. But they certainly seem to see a positive benefit, especially in the Democratic Party, where interests often align ideologically with having and seeing more women there.
Now, you mentioned that women find ways around barriers. Are there common ways that are that women take to get around these barriers?
Well, I think it's interesting, right? Already tonight, we're seeing, for example, the Elizabeth Warren campaign gather its volunteers and figure out how to get childcare to the caucus goers, right? That's one example. So you figure it out, even though it's not a policy of the Democratic Party in Iowa to sort of organize across all the caucuses. You see women, especially women volunteers, trying to make it work and help other people out. Historically, when we've talked about women's political participation, we've talked about them being sort of do-it-yourselfers, right? Like, I'll figure out how to have an impact on this policy or on this process. And often it meant working outside of the system because women had been excluded from formal politics. So they would work in their communities. We see this especially with women of color and Black women. We will mobilize in our community. We will do volunteer efforts. We will do philanthropic efforts in order to make the sorts of policy and political change that we think is most important and to put pressure on our elected officials, even if we're going to be excluded from being those elected officials. One thing that has been interesting for organizations like ours that are trying to get more women to run for and serve in elective office is we have to sort of switch the mindset to women now and say, yes, we know you've been able to make change from the outside, but imagine how much change, more change you can make from the inside. And so all of those strategies of figuring out how to kind of go around the system have been quite effective, so effective that now we have to push women to say, look, let's figure out and break down the barriers within the system so that you can also have a seat at all of those tables.
Kelly Dittmar is an assistant professor of political science at Rutgers University and scholar at the Center for American Women and Politics. Kelly, thanks for joining us.
Thanks again for having me.